Oh, hey, folks, I just wanted to insert a quick little note here at the beginning of the show. This one has a lot of personal stories in it, and if that's not why you tune in, you can move along to the next thing that you have to do. I just want to be respectful of your time. One of the nicest compliments that anyone ever gave me was actually from our friend Carlos Morales from Renegade Variety Hour, who said, "You seem like you really respect people's time." Well, damn it, I do. So this is a lot of personal stories and a lot of material that might have been covered on the show in the past. I think this is an interesting conversation. That's why I'm including it. I think the introduction is interesting. That's why I'm including it. But you might have better things to do, so I just want to give you the option. And if I can just take a second here to mention things like schoolsucksproject.com/AV, we could really use some new subscribers. And thanks to everyone who's continuing to chip in for that. Go to our YouTube channel, check out a video that I made, Government Drones, A Promising Future? Question mark. Ooh, what's that about? All right, here's the show. Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is October 1st. Happy Halloween. And what you're going to hear on the show today is a discussion I had a couple weeks ago with Kevin Cascella, the host of Freedom Loving Podcast. Many of you might recognize Kevin's name because he was also the host of a show that I really enjoyed, Healthy Mind, Fit Body. He did that with our friend Wes, and I highly recommend you check out both. But we go through the development of the show and some discussion about school versus education. It was an interesting conversation, a different conversation. Always wanted to have Kevin on the show, so this will do for now, and maybe he'll come back in the future. I mean, let's say definitely Kevin will come back in the future. And a couple of things I want to get into, first of all, because you're going to hear this talked about in the show. I talk about why I didn't want to do SAT tutoring anymore. I do have to report to you that this past weekend, I wrapped up an SAT class in Farmington, Connecticut. I taught for about 40 kids in an amphitheater. I felt like one of those real college professors. It was pretty neat. It was in a public school. And man, let me tell you, things change fast, right? Because the last time I actually worked for a company doing stuff like this, like there was, I think, a background check that you have to submit to, which is, I think that's understandable. If you're going to be around kids, people should know who you are, right? But for this job, there was like Department of Homeland Security paperwork. I had to get fingerprinted. I had to go into a police station in order to go into this school and teach the class. I had to go into like the bowels of a police department in Connecticut. And that's a scary feeling. That's a hell of a time to find out that like you're a fugitive for thought crimes or whatever, when there's two locked doors, neither of which you have the keys to, between you and the outside world, and you're standing there with a cop who's putting in your social security number and your fingerprints. It was pretty intense. But everything went fine, me and this officer. We had a nice conversation. I was approved, which is great news, you know, that no one is looking for me yet. And that they also chose this massively complex and expensive bureaucratic process over Googling my name, you know. And I went into the school and I would have to say it was a big success. I was using new material. It was interesting. I'm working for this company. I'm not going to mention who they are. But I think I said in an earlier show that I really felt, or I think I say in this show, their philosophy aligns nicely with, you know, my teaching style. And I had to abandon all the material for the SAT that I had been preparing for years in favor of working from their book, which is a little different, but there's some overlap and it was a lot of new stuff to learn. But I'd say it went pretty well. I enjoyed it. It was neat to have a room full, like a whole classroom. It was the biggest class that I ever taught, 40 people. Oh, wait, maybe when I was student teaching, I had like 30 kids. But this was the biggest group, and it was an amphitheater. It was really neat. I had a projector. I had a smart board. Oh, man, public school. That's the gig. So anyway, all that being said, that's where I am currently in my career. I hope you don't mind if I just share a little personal story with you. I've talked a lot in the past about this boarding school that I used to work at. And as I was updating my resume and like digging out old letters of recommendation, I had some letters written by administrators at this school where I used to be employed. And I said, I better make sure these are still relevant, you know, because I mean, I have plenty of letters of recommendation that I can use. And I had a couple nice ones from these administrators. And I went to the school's website to make sure these people were still in the school's employ. you know, and the website was gone. Now, this is a company that I worked for. This is where I got my start in education. From the very end of 1999 until the middle of 2006. In a variety of locations, two different schools, but all run by the same people. So this school that had been in Bennington, Vermont, I've never said the name of the school, but you're about to learn it, and I'm going to talk about it in a little bit of detail here. I don't know how I feel about this yet. There's something cathartic about this whole, what I'm going to tell you. Now, there was like a skeleton of the website. There was still a sitemap, but there was no picture. All the links were dead. So I just do a Google search for Bennington School, and some articles come up. I wanted to share one of them with you. Now, before we get into this, let's just talk about why this was important. Let's start here. I was in college in the 90s, and I took my second semester of my junior year off, and I came back to Massachusetts, and I did an internship with my uncle's production company. It was called Zolo Productions. If I've never mentioned this before, my uncle, my mother's brother, is a film producer, and he did some notable movies like Mississippi Burning and Quiz Show and The Paper, and was married for many years to Barbara Broccoli, who is the executive producer of the James Bond movie. And maybe some of you are saying, Brett, these are connections that you should really try to cultivate. Would you like to hear about who some of their best friends are? The Goodwins. The Doris Kearns Goodwin and her husband, Richard. That's their scene. They would find what I'm doing probably pretty repulsive, if that's where their respect tends to go. We really aren't that close anyway, so I don't even know him that well. But his partner at the time in the late 90s was a guy named Nick Palaiologos, who had been in the 80s and the 90s a Massachusetts state congressman. He was in the Massachusetts State House, and he was on the Education Committee, or what I called at the time the Education Committee, what we would recognize today as the Public School Committee. And he was also a film producer, so he had a number of impressive credits, and he was really passionate, it seemed, about a number of issues. And when I was his intern or his production assistant, I had the office the size of a respectable walk-in closet with no windows. It had a metal desk and a rotary phone. The room was filled with people's scripts that had been sent to the production company, and I would read them. But he had all these files and, you know, all these news clippings, all these times that he had been in the paper, and he seemed like he had a real social conscience. And, you know, at this time, I was in college, so I was very influenced by this history professor that I had, and I was realizing that the world was a lot bigger than I initially understood it to be. There was a lot more going on. There was a lot I hadn't been taught. And I was developing, I felt like, a social conscience of my own. So Nick became very much a role model. And I said, you know, I want to get out there and I want to do something that matters. That was really, honestly, the first time in my life, this was like 1999, that occurred to me. Doing something with my life that mattered. And, you know, up until that point, I had worked while I was in college. I had two jobs. I was a cashier at a convenience store, and I was a cashier at a video store. When I went back to school in the fall of 1999, I said, the next time I get a job, first of all, everything changed. I had been like a really mediocre student up until that point. And, you know, I was having some success in these very difficult history courses, but I went from like having a, you know, like a 2.2 GPA to making the national dean's list. My whole outlook was really transformed, you know, partly by this history professor, but also by the experience I had being a production assistant for this guy, Nick Palaiologos, who, interestingly enough, went on to run something called the Massachusetts Film Office. And their job was to try to bring like big Hollywood film projects to Massachusetts to be filmed. One movie that he got was The Departed, but because of some of the regulatory obstacles in Massachusetts, many of the exteriors for The Departed, like city scenes, were actually filmed in Manhattan. Anyway, let's close the book on Nick. I go back to school in the fall of 1999, and I start itching for something meaningful to do because I need to make money while I'm in school. And in December, a guy who works at the convenience store with me says, you know, my other job is at this school, this residential school. You should come check it out. They pay $8.50 an hour. I said, holy shit, $8.50 an hour? Is the job hard? He said, yeah, it's really hard. It's terrible. It's really, really rough. I said, yeah, but $8.50 an hour times 40, that's almost incalculable. So I went down like within the next couple of weeks and I applied. I met with the residential coordinator and he hired me because later I found out that they hire anyone who goes in there and applies for the job of residential counselor. So I start working there and I have like the worst kind of grunt job, taking sheets off peed beds, physically intervening with kids who don't cooperate. But anyway, it becomes apparent to me that this is not changing the world. This is not the asserting a new social conscience kind of experience that I wanted to have. So I started to look, after I was just there for 3 or 4 months, I started to look for ways that I could move up. And, you know, I asked the supervisors, what do I need to do to show to these people who run this place that I'm smart? You know, I'm about to graduate from college and I want to move up. So after a few months, I wind up getting promoted to the position of outdoor educator where I can take kids on adventure trips. And this was like the sweetest that this job was ever going to be. I would take kids kayaking. I would take kids skiing. I would get paid to ski, and that was a pretty good deal, and I didn't really have any complaints about that. And obviously, having kids outside of the school environment or the residential environment was such a breath of fresh air, literally, and so entirely different and so much more enjoyable. But as I kind of worked my way up in the dorms, I also started serving as an interim supervisor, and this burned me out very quickly because this was like the worst of the worst. And in the middle of 2001, I quit because I was just burned out. I was 23 years old at the time. And I took a job to use this degree that I had been itching to use in communications. So I took a marketing job at a ski resort. And unfortunately, the travel industry got 9/11 that fall, so I was laid off. And I went back to the school in January of 2002. And I asked to work in education when I came back. And so I was a teacher's aide for a while. Again, just followed this plan of, you know, doing what you need to do in a job like this to get promoted. And I pitched to them in 2002 that I wanted to be the lead teacher, because I was also now attending graduate school for education. So I wanted to be the lead teacher of this specialized program for kids with sexually reactive behavior issues. And this was considered to be the worst place in this school that was already bad enough no matter where you went. And I said, I want to teach there. And if I, put in my time there and you think I'm competent, I want you to move me to Great Expectations, which is a school they were running about 30 minutes north of there in the resort town of Manchester, Vermont. And that's what happened. I worked there from 2002 to 2004 at this specialized campus. The teacher quit in 2004. I was given that job. I worked there till 2006, and then that was the end of my teaching. But this is an important part of my development, obviously, because this is where I started to get really disillusioned. I mentioned several times on the show that this was a real waking up experience for me, right? Because the social consciousness that I had developed was like, oh, well, I guess I'll have to be in government or working for the government so I can make a real difference in the world. And this is where I saw how children in government care were treated. And this is everything from the environment to the drugs. And also around this time, even though I didn't really have the grammar for understanding residential care and understanding Medicaid and state custody, I really started to develop the suspicion that something was fishy here. But all it was a feeling, right? Because most people who work in jobs like that, as far as the ins and outs of that business, and it's called, you know, a for-profit company, even though all their money comes from the state. But I didn't have the knowledge to make any sense of it. It was just a feeling. And, feelings usually aren't good enough to act on. So I kind of went along to get along in the time I was there. This feeling grew and grew and grew until about 2006. And I didn't feel like, even though I was in a much better place teaching history at this other school, I didn't want to be doing this anymore. I didn't like the way it felt. I wasn't looking forward to going to work. So where am I taking you with this whole story? This goes back to me finding a couple of articles. The first one was in a paper called the Bennington Banner, which was the paper of record for Southern Vermont. And the other one comes from the website called FBI.gov, Albany Division. United States, and this is just an FBI press release. United States and the state of Vermont enter into global resolution with former officers of Bennington School Incorporated relating to tax and health care fraud violations. May 7th, 2013. The one in the Bennington banner is called Family Members Take Plea Deal for Fraud Involving Bennington School. So I'm going to share with you the FBI press release here. The Office of the United States Attorney and the District of Vermont and the Office of Vermont Attorney General stated today that they have entered into global resolution of criminal and civil investigative matters concerning alleged tax and health care fraud by former officers of Bennington School Incorporated. Defendant Matthew Merritt Jr., age 81, the president and trustee of Bennington School, his son, Defendant Matthew Merritt III, age 54, BSI's plant manager, and his son-in-law, Defendant Raymond Crowley, age 58, who served as CFO of BSI, have agreed to plead guilty to one charge each of federal tax fraud. In addition, Matthew Merritt Jr. will plead guilty to a federal charge of engaging in a scheme to defraud a healthcare program. To resolve potential civil healthcare fraud liability, the three Merritt family members have agreed to pay a total of $3 million to the United States and the state of Vermont. Defendant Jeffrey Labonte, age 59, the executive director of BSI, also agreed to plead guilty to a federal tax fraud charge and will pay $1.3 million to resolve his potential civil health care fraud liability. Of the total $4.3 million recovery, the state of Vermont will receive $2,113,708, and the United States will receive $2,186,992. This Jeffrey Labonte, he was the executive director. So he was, I mean, from the point of view that we could see the school, none of these other people, you know, trustees, presidents, I mean, we knew their names, but he appeared to be the guy who was on the scene and running everything. He told a room full of teachers at a staff meeting. I think I might have told this story before. If you don't like what's going on here, you can all quit and I'll have you replaced next Monday in a kind of a morale building session. Second paragraph. Until 2013, BSI, a for-profit, closely held corporation, operated a residential program in Bennington, Vermont, that offered therapeutic and educational services, air quotes, for socially and emotionally challenged boys and girls. Over the course of the last two decades, the state of Vermont placed many students at BSI and was responsible for their tuition and other expenses. And I'm just going to add to this, this was true for a number of other states too. Maryland, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York was a big one. Washington, D.C., a lot of kids came from D.C. The funding for these placements came from the Vermont Medicaid program, approximately 60% federal funding and 40% state funding, and from several Vermont state agencies, including the Agency of Education, the Department of Mental Health, and the Department for Children and Families. This funding was based on a per diem rate for each student, determined on an annual basis by the Division of Rate Setting within the Vermont Agency of Human Services. The annual rate set by the DRS, the Division of Rate Setting, was determined upon a review of BSI's application materials, including various accounting reports and budgets. In particular, the formula for the rate was calculated by the DRS for Medicaid and education payments to BSI based upon the school's reported allowable expenses. The higher the allowed expenses, the higher per diem rate for each student. However, not all of BSI's claimed allowable expenses were in fact allowable for the rate calculation. For example, BSI President Matthew Merritt Jr. and Executive Director Jeffrey Labonte, with the assistance of CFO Raymond Crowley and Plant Manager Matthew Merritt III, implemented a system, and yes, this was very strange, and I often wondered what the hell was going on here, of compensating certain employees of BSI, in addition to their salary amounts, by providing personal benefits such as cars, gasoline, oil for personal residence, payments of personal expenses on credit card accounts, salaries for family members who did not work at BSI, and reimbursements for various personal expenses. These forms of compensation were never reported on the individual's tax returns. In addition, these unallowable expenses were embedded in the books and records of BSI, which were used to create the reports, budgets, and other financial documents that BSI presented to the Department of Rate Setting, or the Division of Rate Setting, excuse me, as accurate and allowable for rate setting. The government's investigation arose in 2011 following a request by BSI for a rate change due to reduced enrollment. In processing that request, DRS auditors took a close look at some of the financial information submitted and determined an on-site audit should be performed. The audit, completed in 2012, resulted in a recalculation of the rate BSI received during the years 2003 to 2012. And I was an employee there, just for the record, from really the beginning of 2000 until the middle of 2006. But I was on site at this Bennington School Incorporated that they're talking about from 2000 to 2004. DRS calculated the total amount of overpayment by the state during those years to be over $3.6 million. Under the False Claims Act, 31 U.S.C. number 3729, and potential state law remedies, should the government prevail at trial, the defendants would be liable for treble damages, T-R-E-B-L-E, which just means triple. It's a legal term. It's actually British. And what if you are compensated $1,000 for something that happens, if treble damages are applied, you get $3,000. So that's the money coming back to the state. The defendants would be liable for treble damages, as well as mandatory penalties up to $11,000 per claim. The defendants dispute DRS's calculation, and the parties have settled to avoid further investigation and litigation. For his federal health care fraud conviction, Matthew Merritt Jr. faces a maximum term of imprisonment of 10 years. For his federal tax fraud conviction, Matthew Merritt Jr. faces a maximum prison term of 3 years. Pursuant to a written plea agreement, the parties have agreed that Matthew Merritt Jr.'s total term of imprisonment shall not exceed 24 months. For their federal tax fraud convictions, Matthew Merritt III and Raymond Crowley each face a maximum prison term of 3 years. Pursuant to a written plea agreement, the parties have agreed that Matthew Merritt III and Raymond Crowley's prison term should not exceed 18 months. For his federal tax fraud conviction, Jeffrey Labonte faces a maximum prison term of 3 years. Pursuant to a written plea agreement, the government has agreed to make the nature and extent of Jeffrey Labonte's cooperation known to the federal court, and as a result of his cooperation, request that the court sentence Labonte to a term of imprisonment below that recommended by the advisory sentencing guidelines. Tristan J. Coffin, United States attorney, noted that, quote, schemes such as the one employed by these former BSI officials exact a significant toll on federal and state programs. Top officials at a for-profit organization that held itself out as serving an important public mission engaged in a fraud scheme involving government health care program payments. In addition, these same individuals filed false income tax returns. The prosecution of health care fraud offenses is a top priority for the Department of Justice, and coupling such fraud with tax violation makes these types of crimes even more egregious. Our office will continue to vigorously pursue and prosecute individuals who engage in such conduct. The American taxpayer deserves no less. The United States and the state of Vermont acknowledged that the scheme at issue here did not impact the quality of services offered to students at BSI. How could it? The school continues to operate fully as a licensed residential treatment program. However, as of January 1st, 2013, management and ownership of the programs at Bennington School were transferred to the Vermont Permanency Initiative Incorporated, which is part of the Beckett family of services. Matthew Merritt Jr. has resigned as president and trustee of BSI, Jeffrey Labonte, Matthew Merritt III, and Raymond Crowley have left the school's employ. This matter was investigated by United States Attorney's Office, the Medicaid Fraud and Abuse Unit of the Vermont Attorney General's Office, the Internal Revenue Service, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Office of Inspector General, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The United States Attorney Coffin commends the investigative agencies for their hard work on this criminal and civil investigation. I bet it was hard work. I bet there was a lot that had to go into this, right? Because we're talking about almost $4 million of money stolen from taxpayers, which is easy to do when bureaucrats are watching it. Who knows what the cost was of reclaiming it? What will be the cost of incarcerating these people? Do the taxpayers, quote unquote, break even in this matter? Or is this a loss? And this last paragraph just talks about who everyone's lawyer is. I don't even want to give them the attention, those lawyers. So that closes the book on a very interesting and very impactful and eye-opening phase of my career at Bennington School. And, in the series we recently did called Presence and Productivity, Richard Grove and Tony Myers and I talked a lot about the rewards of identification. So the entire time I worked there, there were all these things that didn't seem on the up and up. This is fishy. That is fishy. But I didn't understand. I didn't even know what Medicaid was when I was doing this job. And most people in my position probably had no idea, right? That was not, things were very compartmentalized. And if you didn't need to know how all of this worked, my job was just to, you know, stand in this little room that was filled with medication. And that medication came from somewhere, but, you know, that wasn't my responsibility to know where it was, and I handed it out to people. Because somebody who was more qualified and smarter had decided that that's where that medication needed to go. So the rewards of identification, you know, I mean, being able to look back at this, and it's very clear. This makes a lot of sense. And based on some of the interactions that I had with a couple of the people who are mentioned in this FBI press release, I'm not really surprised or upset.
Welcome to freedomlovin.com, where we focus on building freedom in an unfree world. Through personal development, location independence, and passive income strategies. Now here's your host, Kevin Koskela.
Welcome to another episode of the Freedom Lovin' Podcast. This is Kevin, and in just a minute, I have an interview coming up with Brett Vinat of the School Sucks Podcast, and we'll talk about why school sucks and what you can do about it, among a few other things. So, great interview, great time, and stay tuned for that. I have a really awesome announcement that I'm super excited about, and that is that we got a new iTunes review. Rating and a review. I'm so stoked to read this off. So this one comes from Taylor PL. I think that's a PL. And he says, the title is Libertarianism Meets Lifestyle Design. From lifestyle design to entrepreneurship to libertarianism, Kevin does a great job in taking the listeners along for the ride with proving insightful interviews and sharing his own experiences from living a digital nomad lifestyle. Love the Harry Brown theme. Thanks a lot, Taylor. Really appreciate that. And if you, the listener, you want to give us a review, I will also read your review on the show. What could be better than that? Yeah, and I also got an email from a listener out in, I think it was Norway, and he found the show recently and has been listening to some of the podcasts, and he gave me a list of his favorite books and said, why don't I talk about some of my favorite books? And I'm not going to do that right now exactly, but I will either do a blog post on that, or maybe it'll be a discussion topic of a future Freedom Loving podcast. I think that's a really good idea. So he gave me, his list was a lot of economics textbooks, or not textbooks, but books about economics. And all of the ones that I could see were really good, like Murray Rothbard and some of the Austrian economic school of thought. And I was really into that stuff for a while, but I feel like I learned all I needed to learn back a few years ago. And I don't really feel like more knowledge in that realm is benefiting me. You may feel different. I don't think that's for everybody, but I am more into the psychology right now, communication and relationships type books when it comes to nonfiction. But yeah, right now I'm getting through that book, Start With Why, by Simon Sinek. And I've got a whole bunch more that I want to read, but I don't like to start new books when I haven't finished current books. So I'm also reading Pete Sisko's book, The Freedom App, and I'll have him on the show soon. That'll be the next podcast after this one, actually. So stay tuned for that. And also, one more thing, there is a new offer. You've heard me mention the website 100mustreads.com, which is a list of business books. It's business book summaries. And before, the deal was, it was $25 for about 119 business book summaries, and they're kind of a broad range of different books. And now, and it's my site, if there was any mystery behind that, it's my site, so it's not a sponsor of the show, it's more of just like a partner. And what we're doing now is we're offering, because people want to know, they want to see what the writing is like, what the summaries are like before they commit to the 120. So we're offering 10 business book summaries that we picked out. And so there's 10 summaries, and it's 99 cents. So that's a pretty, pretty sweet deal. I'll put the link in the show notes. You can go right now. If you want to get the full list, you can go to 100mustreads.com, and I'll have the link to the 99-cent deal in the show notes. So just go to freedomlovin.com, and you'll see that in this podcast. So check that out. And without further ado, here's my interview with Brett Vinat. And go out there and build some freedom, and we'll talk to you soon. All right. Well, I'm really excited to have Brett Vinat on the show today. And Brett is the host of the School Sucks podcast, and his website is schoolsucksproject.com. Hey, Brett, welcome to Freedom Lovin'.
Hey, Kevin, it's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's funny. We were just talking before the show about how it seems like we know each other really well, but we've only actually talked one other time, and it's just through our podcasts and mutual friends and things like that, that we just we know a lot about each other and have a lot in common. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you start with School Sucks Project and the podcast, and how did your background kind of lead you to getting involved with that?
Sure. I would say, I don't remember what actually triggered me to do it. There was like a confluence of things around 2006 where I had started to listen to other people's podcasts. A friend of mine who, well, he's kind of a friend, a mentor named Richard Grove had the first podcast I ever heard in like 2006. And, you know, that got me thinking like, well, man, I could do that. I've got a lot of ideas. And, you know, then I started listening to like Free Talk Live and our mutual friend Wes Bertrand's Complete Liberty within the next year. And, you know, my head, as I was listening to these people and thinking about all the things that they were saying, but also, you know, all my own experience and around government schooling and my interest in education, this storm of ideas just started, you know, swirling in my head. And I wanted to do it as a documentary film initially, and I wrote a treatment. And I pitched it to a couple of people I knew, like places that I thought would be safe and encouraging. And it was crapped on a little bit. Yeah. And I kind of tabled it for a while. I had an old MacBook at the time, and I started using just GarageBand to get out my thoughts into an audio file. And it was like, this is like 2006, 2007. I recorded like 4 hours of stuff, and I then put it on my iPod, and I would drive around, like it felt like for weeks, listening to myself talk about it. And it was around 2008 where I wrote Wes an email after I'd listened to his show, and I asked him if there would be a way that I could audition for like being a co-host on Complete Liberty podcast.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, we'll save the formal edition. You can just come on. And I said, I'd like to talk about education for maybe an hour or so. And we wound up talking for like 6 or 7 hours. I think we got like 5 or 6 full shows out of it.
Yeah.
And that really, there was that bug that just, is that how you say it? A bug that bit me? That doesn't sound right. But yeah, I got the podcasting bug at that point. And Wes and I worked together a couple more times in early in 2009. And in the meantime, I'm listening back to the shows that we had done together because I was like, I was so proud of putting out all of those thoughts, you know, even though the sound quality wasn't good, even though my thoughts weren't like totally organized at the time. And I said, I'm going to start doing this because all these things that I said, I could improve upon this. I could expand this. I already have this, you know, documentary treatment that outlined 3 acts of a story about the government schools.
Yeah.
And I started the podcast in August of 2009, building on all of this inspiration of having listened to and worked with people like Richard Grove or Wes or Steph or the Free Talk Live guys. And all of my prior experience in education, which at that point had been, this is 2009, so almost a decade, maybe like 9 years of experience in and around the government schools, residential schools, private tutoring. And I felt like I had learned a lot. I felt like there was a lot of frustration that I had been holding inside. And what I realized was the podcast became like a real therapeutic tool for externalizing all of that stuff. So that's the nutshell.
Yeah. And so what was your experience like in school? Were you like a good student and you liked it? Or were you just like, school sucks, I'm going to do something with my life, there's nothing to do with this? Or,
you know, did I ever form the thought? I think that it really shows a lot of precociousness and independence in thought. When I started working with these kids who were labeled juvenile delinquents, and they were telling me that school sucks, they were telling me that the police sucked, that society sucked. And I'm like, no, you got to be positive. Because when I was a kid, I was like, you know, oh, it's too bad that I suck. because that's how school made me feel.
Yeah.
And I just was, you know, living in this quiet resignation of, oh, you know, it's too bad this is the way it is because this really doesn't work for me. In some aspects in school, I really enjoyed. I got involved in ninth grade in something called newspaper publications with this great teacher who I always want to go back to the high school and see because I think he's still there. His name was Bob Schneider, and he was my English teacher, and I wound up having him for a bunch of English courses, and I did the newspaper all 4 years that I was there. And it was a great experience because I loved to write. We would do, you know, news stuff. I would do like creative stuff, and that was a great experience. But yeah, most of school was, it wasn't for me, but I don't think I ever stopped and said that to myself that school sucks. I was good at the things I enjoyed and not good at the things that I thought were a waste of time. And I think a lot of people have a similar story.
Yeah, it's really similar with me. I didn't at the time think about it much. It was just like, this is what you do. And I got to just grind through all this. And then hopefully I get into a decent college. And then I grind through that. And hopefully nothing ever occurred to me that I actually just hated it. And until actually around, I think it was around 2004, when I met Wes Bertrand, and he gave me his business card, and there was a link to logicallearning.net, and I went to it, and he had like just tons of essays on there about school and all the problems, and I was like, holy crap, this is exactly how I've been feeling this whole time. Like, I never was able to put it into words, or I just didn't really think about it, but that's exactly how I felt about school, and I hated it, you know, and I would go to classes and just like put my head on the desk and fall asleep. You know, is that a problem? Like, you know, but I just thought that I was just unmotivated and I was lazy, and, you know, I never thought like there's this huge problem with the whole system. So
I will say this, though, when I came across Wes's work and, you know, Free Talk Live to a lesser extent, because it was really Wes's work that I found to be so transformative. I've described it before as like in the years prior, I had been making a collage of all of the things that I thought were wrong, you know, with schooling, and all of the things that I thought were right and needed to be explicated about what education was. But the collage, when I started to understand the philosophy of liberty, the collage really started to turn into a mind map where there was something anchoring all of these ideas at the center. And all of these things that I was feeling about, you know, the state or about war or about the government schooling system, it started to make sense once there was this philosophical container into which it could all go. That really helped build my confidence in my ability to communicate these ideas because I was less scatterbrained once this mind map was created. So that was definitely really helpful.
Cool. So what is the problem with schools? I know that's your entire podcast, which is like, you know, 4 years long worth of information, but can you kind of describe, like, in a nutshell, what the problem is? Because I think a lot of people out there are like, you know, I didn't love school, but it was all right. And here I am, I'm doing okay. And how bad can it be?
Yeah, I think this, again, is that I'll bring up that term again, that philosophical container. When we try to explain these things in an isolated way to people, like, oh, government school is bad, or there's this expanding police state, or, you know, we have a foreign policy driven by corporations and central banks. Like, when you tell people that, they're like, oh, that's adorable. You're like one of those activists who holds a sign and wants to save the whales.
Yeah.
You know, because you're an anomaly if you're passionate about something that's not directly related to your life, even though that stuff is directly related to your life, but people are disconnected from it. So when we start trying to explain the realities of schooling to people, it's very off-putting because people don't want to recognize that they were kind of deceived, and they don't want to, I think anyway, from my observations, and people occasionally have admitted as much to me, they're sending their children there. So they only want to look so closely. They're like, yeah, it's bad. I'm trying to monitor it. But, you know, it's, we all have to do it.
Right.
That kind of a thing. But they really don't want to dig deep and see the psychological damage and really the damage to the spirit and the motivation and the individuality of the student that they're sending there. Mm-hmm. So as far as what the problem is, the biggest problem for me is that people equate schooling with education.
Yeah.
As far as the state is concerned, the schools are fantastic. It's the golden egg laying goose, you know, generation after generation, year after year, it's pumping out a obedient, apathetic population on matters of the state and society,
right,
where people have learned to outsource their thinking to so-called experts and authorities. And that's very, very dangerous. And, you know, compulsory school is over 200 years old in the Western world anyway. I mean, you could trace it back even farther than that. But in its current form, the Prussian model that, you know, grew out of Central Europe and into Western Europe and eventually into the United States and onto Japan. That's run its course in certain places, and you can see what the results of that inculcation of obedience have been. Mm-hmm. I would say most strongly in Germany, which is, you know, during the middle of the last century, where I've directed some of my focus in the past with podcasts and videos.
Yeah.
So obedience to authority, blind obedience to authority, is a very, very big problem. But it's also like in my more violent communicating days, I would say to somebody, if they watch Fox News, I'd say you're in a worse position than somebody who somebody who's been in a cave their whole life. Because the person who's been in the cave, they know they don't know anything. You're right. Getting this illusion of knowledge. So when people equate schooling with education, you see that there's a lot of people, you know, mostly like college freshmen and sophomores following their professors around, and they think they're pretty damn smart. And the truth is that they are smart, but they're being given this counterfeit knowledge. And that's incredibly dangerous, because when we have this counterfeit knowledge, our learning slows down, and sometimes it stops. You say, well, I already know everything. I'm, you know, I'm a sophomore at Cornell University. What else could there be that I haven't figured out?
Right, yeah. So the argument that I get, I'm sure you've heard this a million times, is that, okay, Brett, so you don't like schools, so let's get rid of schools. And then what happens? There'd be millions of parents that would not send their kids to school. They wouldn't be educated. There'd be this whole generation of just illiterate people. And society would just, like, fall apart, right?
Well, I think if we pressed a button and ended school tomorrow, that I don't see why that wouldn't be true.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about the installation of this dependent mindset generation after generation, and again, the equating of government schooling to education, if that disappeared tomorrow, yeah, I don't know. I mean, our parents, the 95% of parents who are out there in the country right now, have they prepared their children to be independent, self-sufficient learners? I don't think so. Where would they have had training to do that? You know, they're outsourcing that responsibility to the schools. And I think that's part of the reason why they have to tell themselves a story about the schools, because they care about their children. You know, they want their children to have a good education. So the easiest thing to do with all the other stress of life and all of the other busyness of work and family is like, yeah, okay, for 35 hours a week, they go to this place and that's education. And it's not. And that's something that I think people have to face. Now, as far as the transition out of the system, that's a very good question. I realize that there's a variety of different situations in which people find themselves. I have two brothers. They both have kids. These kids are probably going to go to government school, you know? I mean, and that's certainly upsetting to me, because now, especially a couple of them, I see at the ages of 4 and 5, and I just see how wonderful and brilliant and filled with imagination they are. It's going to be sad, I think, to maybe see them at the age of 13 or 14 when they're stuck in the seemingly endless morass of middle school. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not looking forward to that 8 or 9 or 10 years from now. It doesn't mean they can't recover from that.
Yeah.
But so to most people, the things that we're talking about are, at least they seem unrealistic. I can't take my kid out of school tomorrow. My youngest brother has a 13-year-old who is in middle school. And I'm trying to start encouraging him to do this, because he's reached that age where obviously he could be left alone. He doesn't need to be supervised. And I'm starting to try and plant these seeds. But, you know, there's another parent involved and they're not together. And what would her attitude be about, you know, letting this kid educate himself? What's the transition like? There are all these questions. But I think a phrase that I've really grabbed onto in the last year is intellectual self-defense. There's no reason why you can't survive 15,000 hours of government school. It's obviously not ideal. Everybody should get out of there if they can, if they have an exit route.
Right.
They should do it. But part of what I want to do on the show, in addition to just pointing out these problems, is hopefully be providing tools for survival if there is no other way. Because the worst thing that I could do as somebody presenting this material is present all this information. Yeah, look how bad this sucks.
Yeah.
And that just leads to them saying, well, you know, there's nothing I can do. I'll give up hope and I'll just trudge through it and I won't try. So they're, you know, forming all of these bad habits. Their motivation is sapped and they just feel like there's no hope.
Right.
So I want to make sure that, yeah, this is considered one of the country's most sacred institutions. So people need to know that it's bad.
Yeah.
And they need to know what the problems are and what the intentions of government schooling in the United States were and how it's being used by all these different groups. From, if we go through the history over the last 100 years or so, from the Ku Klux Klan to the United Nations, right? Because it's this perfect institution where minds are controlled and agendas can be inserted without question.
Yeah.
So it's very, very dangerous in that respect. But yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that if parents listen to the show, it motivates them to, if their kids are in school, to see what they can do. And I've gotten emails from people who say, I took my kids out of school because of the show.
Wow.
And that was amazing. That was absolutely amazing. Other kids who said, I convinced my parents to let me leave school because of the show. And those are few and far between.
Sure.
But that certainly feels good when it happens. So really, I think the important thing is to recognize that that's not a reality, that there's so many things going on in the school. No matter how many shows I do or how good I can make the show, there's things that I'm not going to be able to change. Just like I realized when people used to say to me, oh, if you know, if you want to change the system, you got to work from within the system.
Yeah.
Which is a very polite and kind of encouraging way to tell somebody to shut the hell up.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you go get on that treadmill in that room by yourself where people are throwing darts at you and you walk on that treadmill, right? With a picture of your destination on the wall, and you leave me alone because I want to pretend that, all this is okay. And I think too, you know, I don't want to be too harsh. I think that people really believe that, because what else would they have learned?
Right.
Of course, every time systems changed, it was because people rebelled against them and changed them from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Systems don't change from the inside. I can't think of any evidence of that. I'd like people to, you know, let me know if I'm overlooking anything. But systems always change from the outside. So that's where we are, very much on the outside. That's where I've been most of my career, if not in, you know, actual location, at least in mindset. And that's where I felt the most powerful. I reach as many people a week with the podcast as I would have reached in two careers of being a teacher.
Oh, yeah.
So
for sure.
At least, maybe more. That's very encouraging and that's very empowering.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing about being alive today, is that we can reach a lot of people just on our own merits. We don't have to have degrees and letters after our name and things like that. You just pick up a microphone or even start blogging. I mean, it's like, yeah, it's really cool and really amazing. And I think that's what gives me hope for the future, is that we've got so many different avenues that we can spread, you know, good memes, I guess, and get the word out there. And, you know, I think that's just going to help, I guess, kind of, there's going to be more sources for news and education and things like that. So it's just a natural, I think, evolution that we go towards a system where there's choices in every aspect of life, you know, not just what you're going to have for dinner or whatever. It's going to be like, what type of education do you want? How do you want to be educated? I mean, it can't just be one thing the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, I really think it's like when people say, well, then how will people be educated? You know, first of all, they're not being educated now. So that's certainly an important thing to recognize.
Right.
And the second question is, well, who the heck would I be to decide?
Yeah.
You know, it's like telling somebody that, you know, they shouldn't eat sugar.
Yeah.
And then, well, what am I going to do? You know, I have no idea. Well, okay, you know, what else do you like? What else do you enjoy cooking? What, you know, all these, like, that's not up to me. If you don't like sugar and, you know, Wonder Bread, I'm not suddenly in charge of planning your meals for you if I point out that those things are bad.
Yeah.
It's up to the individual. And I think people, that seems so foreign, but I think that that's something that people really need to understand, because nobody would want them telling another person telling them what they should have for dinner.
Yeah.
So I think that that analogy is at least useful here in illustrating how differently people need to think about what education is.
Yeah, a couple of questions that I had that are kind of related. One is, the school system, the way it's designed now, it just kind of dumbs people down. It takes out their curiosity. And it leads to people just kind of looking for the next step where someone can tell them what to do. So naturally, they go into corporations and get a job, and then they work, you know, 8, 9, 10 hours a day. And there's not a lot of thinking because there's no time. How did some people get out of that mindset? Like, what do you think is, what's the key in getting out of that? Because most of us went through either public school or something very similar to public school in a private school type of thing. And yet there's a few people that got out and became entrepreneurs and, you know, kind of looked at the whole system differently. And how do you think they did that?
That's a great question. I think there could be as many different answers to that as the education and the meal question, you know? Everybody's path is different. I mean, obviously, the age of information, the internet. I mean, I'll tell you my story. I found one thing that was interesting to me, you know, and it was in college and it was history. And it was because I had a really enthusiastic and really knowledgeable professor on that one subject. And I always add the caveat that he was a socialist, or at the very least, very left wing. And, you know, had stories about the wonderful heroics of FDR and Lyndon Johnson and Abraham Lincoln. And I don't agree with that stuff today. But what stuck with me is that he knew a lot of detail and he was very enthusiastic. He used to get very, very sweaty. He could talk for 2 hours straight. I was very inspired by that. And I realized that just from listening to his stories, that there was something to history that had always been presented in such a bland and unbearable way in government school. And it was this wonderful discovery that, wait a minute, things aren't as they were explained to me for the first 12 years of my schooling.
Yeah.
Which I had called my education. Right. And which for, you know, 5 out of 6 people is the only history education that they're ever going to receive. So that revelation that I had been lied to, that history, first of all, the lie that history is boring. And second of all, this sort of Disney version of the history of the country in which we live, that opened my eyes. Now, the internet is a double-edged sword, obviously. Right. Because there's plenty of ways to not think for yourself online, too.
Sure.
And this wonderful achievement that we've as a species, this gift that we've gotten, or I shouldn't say that we've got. I hate to talk collectively like this, but it's not really a gift because I think that humanity earned free time. Right. Through innovation and finding better ways to do things and moving away from being an agrarian society. Suddenly, 100 years ago, people started to experience this new phenomenon called free time, which had existed for the, you know, the super wealthy and the leisure classes for hundreds, if not thousands of years. But suddenly, like most people, you know, the people who had always been the workers, suddenly they had a little free time and they can start going within themselves and their own minds. And they're not just drones anymore. And now, like in the last 15 years, we're seeing that free time is very easy to get eaten up by all of this new stimuli. Right. So people are going back into having their time and their minds controlled by other things. I've fallen into this myself plenty. But the other edge of that internet sword is that all of this opportunity exists. But for me, when I first started to say, OK, I'm into history. I'm into this idea that I've been lied to. I'm going to go find out the truth about stuff. Well, there's 9/11.
Yeah.
And I start there. And I start watching documentaries and I start learning about all these theories of what could have happened. It was very compelling and it pulled me in. It pulled me in. And unfortunately, I didn't have the time management skills or the information literacy to, you know, really effectively pursue an investigation of what actually happened on 9/11.
Yeah,
I don't believe it's what they presented in the comic book, but I also realized that
the 9/11 commission report.
Yeah, which I often refer to as a coloring book, which I think is more if, for people who say, oh, the government investigated themselves and they everything was on the up and up and the recommendation is more government power. Yeah, if you if you believe that's legit, here's a coloring book.
Right.
But it's actually it's a comic book. It's a comic book that they made. But I was not prepared intellectually, not prepared emotionally, not prepared from a time management standpoint to pursue such a massive research project. But based on my interest in pursuing truth. And, you know, maybe it starts out as just as kind of like, I know something you don't know, right? And for some people, it never grows beyond that. Like the lure of the conspiracy theory is, I know something you don't know.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, but the more time I spent online, the more I started to develop information literacy. And this whole question, just if I've lost people, is about how do we break out of the not thinking for ourselves? And yeah, I mean, for me, it was trying to make a conscious effort to be on the right edge of that sword and recognizing the opportunity of the online experience and remembering back to this person who had inspired me so much and trying to emulate that myself. that I'm not right about everything. I don't know, you know, more than all on all of these topics. Like, I, you know, people are always sending me stuff about education as if like I'm the knowledge authority on it. I'm not. There's people in my audience who understand these things better, I'm sure. But I wanted to do what had inspired me in the past. Right. And that was my journey.
Yeah. So in this idea, and you've had Jeremy Franzen on your show, and I've had him on a couple times, and we've talked about this idea of intrinsic motivation. Do you think that kids are, I mean, are they naturally intrinsically motivated? Is this something that we just come into the world with and then it just kind of dulls down after years of school? Or is that something that we can develop?
I think it's natural, and I think it's lost. And through the experience of schooling, where those muscles don't get to be flexed and they atrophy, that getting up in the morning and asking yourself that question that little kids do, I think, unconsciously, what's important to me today? What things have gravity for my attention? And how can I self-actualize? And, you know, how can I get satisfaction from what I'm doing? I think we can reclaim that. But I think that it starts from recognizing what the routine has been for so long. And, you know, I summed it up as three lessons of school. I think there's more than three, but the big ones are the inculcation of obedience, conformity, and intellectual apathy, as if everything is already known and everything has already been decided by authorities. And you can, like, join us and participate in this polite society if you agree with all of that. And also, if you don't, you're going to stand out, and that's going to have social consequences. So people just go along. And it goes back to, like, what do most people think when they see somebody holding a sign? You know, a sign for a cause. They say, oh, there's a crazy person.
Right.
There's a person whose priorities are so out of whack that they have time to hold a sign when they should be buzzing in and out of this beehive like the rest of us.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that recognizing that damage, those lessons, that's the starting point, because once there's identification of that, you know, you can start learning how to undo those things. And of course, everyone's, I don't mean for these answers to sound like cop-outs, but everyone's process is different.
Sure.
But the recognition, I think, is first and foremost. The identification is so essential of what has been done, because then you can learn how to kind of sandblast that stuff off.
Yeah, I think it's tough because I've been out of the whole matrix, so to speak, for a while now, and I've struggled with the whole motivation thing. Like, if I'm not into what I'm doing, it's just like I'm just digging for motivation and trying to figure out, like, well, how am I going to get excited about this thing that I'm doing? And yeah, I think that's, it speaks to a lot of what you're saying, and then also like what you've been talking about in your recent shows about presence and getting things done and things like that is, you know, kind of having that motivation to go through with it and get organized and start doing things. But I don't think for me that's, I think it's kind of been a lifelong struggle. I don't think it's something that I'm like, okay, I'm good and motivated now and it's all intrinsic and I can just move forward.
Right.
No, there's a question that I had, kind of another topic, but a lot of people are really worried about this thing that seems like just this looming huge problem in society that people aren't really talking about as much as I think they need to be. But what do you think about the college loan system? How does it work, and why is it, you know, people say it's a scam and people get kind of tied in for life with these loans?
I'm still really trying to understand this fully. Obviously, market signals are sent to private institutions or, you know, even state institutions that if the government is going to make a bunch of easy money available for this, obviously, the signal that's sent, if all of this money is being made available from the government, is that it's okay to raise tuition. But it's not like the colleges are victims in this like the students are. It's, you know, colleges are very bureaucratic institutions themselves because they're not really part of the real world. You know, I mean, academia is not part of the real world. And especially the more it's been subsidized, the more divorced it gets from reality. Right. And when you subsidize something, progress stops and costs increase.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these government subsidies for higher education have actually led to these institutions, which are probably to a certain extent bureaucratic to begin with. Well, since we're raising tuition, we could probably use a few more vice presidents of this and that. And it's just kind of this very bad spiral. And then, you know, the more the tuition goes up, the more ire is raised about, oh, what are we going to do about the cost of college? But the only answer that anyone has is that the government needs to be more involved. And that's never in lowering costs by being less involved. It's making more money available, which just drives the costs continuously up. But, you know, the college, like, I want to stress that, you know, colleges aren't just, you know, these victims in that situation. Like, we don't want to raise our costs, but we have to keep responding to market signals. You know, there's nothing we can do. I don't think it's like that. And you can look at the industries that are most heavily subsidized, and you maybe look at the last 10, 20, or 30 years and see how costs have been raised in those industries. Healthcare is another one that comes to mind, versus industries that have less government involvement and less government subsidy.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate, because you see these government people, like Obama's coming out saying, you know, oh, all kids should go to college, and we want to help kids go to college, and it all sounds so nice and wonderful, the government's going to help, but it's all this kind of sinister backstory. It has nothing to do with them wanting to help. It's just people are making money off this, and then it promotes everybody going to college, which is not always the best solution, right? I mean, not everybody should go to college.
Yeah, it also is a total failure of economics and, like, basic supply and demand. If everybody has a college education is not worth anything.
Right.
That was true, I would say, 12 years ago when I graduated from undergrad, you know, and I started walking around with this piece of paper as if it was a winning lottery ticket. And people are like, no, that's just a lottery ticket, you know?
Yeah.
Here, we'll put it in the bin with the rest of them, and we'll spin it a few times and we'll see if yours comes out.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I had the same experience. It was a little longer ago, but it was like, I thought my college degree was a ticket to a nice plush job. And then it turned out that wasn't even really a starting point. That was like, okay, great. Everybody else has a degree too. And what else can you do? So it seems like there's a lot of wasted time in college. I see, you know, I live in San Diego right now, and I see you go down to the beach and there's all the college kids, and I just want to shake them and go, this is completely a waste of your time. But, you know, it all looks fun. They're drinking, they're on the beach, and they're having a great time. But it's sort of like delaying life.
Yeah, well, it was neutral, financially neutral. It would still be a waste, but this is actually wasting life while costing money, while sinking you into debt. So you're going to start behind where you were, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, this is too bad. So how do you see education in general changing going forward? I mean, is it going to be a lot of breaking down of the system, or do you think it's just going to keep as is for a while?
I think, well, do we want to talk about, like, public schooling or higher education or?
Yeah, I guess just kind of the public schooling, where it all starts, you know, how people are created and made into these, you know, wonderful citizens through public schools. Like, is that something that you think is going to just kind of continue on for a long time? Or do you think they'll run out of money and just kind of forced that we're going to have to come up with some kind of private solution?
I don't think that the schools are going to run out of money, because I don't see a way that would happen unless people made the choice to stop paying for them.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, as the economy worsens, I mean, people are still, there's not going to be, you know, any kind of property tax holiday. So no matter what happens, I was talking to somebody recently, or I forget where I heard this, but they were talking about contingency plans for the IRS, like how to collect taxes after a nuclear holocaust, right? There are no tax holidays.
Yeah.
I know in Massachusetts, there's a 1-day sales tax holiday.
Uh-huh.
Right. But the idea that the government's revenue stream is going to be choked off, if that happens, the problems are going to be bigger than the government schools. We're going to be in a very bad situation. So, I mean, the funding will continue. I think that we are generations away, at least, I mean, this is how I feel now, from the dissolve of that system. Save some kind of major societal and governmental collapse, those schools are going to be there. And, you know, based on what I know about the past, nothing is going to change. They're going to change the rhetoric, and they're going to change the window dressing, and they're going to try to flash things up with new technology. But I think that people's awareness of the problems for them with government school. You know, the acceptance of things like Khan Academy, the mainstreaming of that, even though, you know, I think there's an agenda there with Khan Academy and his One World Classroom. I certainly have questions about that, but people have at least identified it as an alternative to what has been called education for so long. So the awareness is, I think, is evolving. But the other thing is that people have these bad habits that they learned in government school. And now back to the double-edged sword of the internet, they're on the wrong side of that sword.
Right.
You know, so they aren't realizing, I think, fully the opportunities that exist in the information age. And I'm searching myself here for something encouraging, Kevin, but as far as the future of schooling, I don't really have a bright picture.
Well, you know what I'm amazed at is when I meet teachers, often younger, on the younger side, not like teachers that have been in the system for 40 years and have tenure, but the younger teachers, I find that they're pretty in tune with what's wrong. I mean, they can see it. They'll go, oh yeah, I have to teach for this test and it sucks. And I know my students aren't learning what they need to learn, but this is the only thing that we can do, because if we don't do this, then if the students don't do well on the test, then we don't get funding and then I may get fired, whatever. But I remember talking to a girl a few years back, and she was teaching in a public school, and I think it was somewhere in San Diego. And she said that she would go off the off the rails with her teaching because she wanted her students to learn. So she would sit there and read them like Robert Kiyosaki books, which was completely against the lesson plan. But she's like, they need to learn entrepreneurship. They need to know this stuff. So I'm going to teach it to them. And, you know, some kids would be interested and some wouldn't. I just wonder if things like that are kind of an encouraging sign that there's this kind of groundswell of people that understand the problems and they know that what we need is to be learning about how to run a business, not all these dates that we should be memorizing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people who understand the problem, but there's also being trapped in that system. And, you know, education, psychiatry, these are obedient professions.
Yeah.
Right. Where it's a very difficult cycle to break. And even though there are a few bright lights of people who are trying to break out of the cycle for themselves, like this woman that you're talking about. Yeah. You know, the experts hand this stuff down. And, you know, I can add as a teacher my own creative flair to it and, you know, decorate my classroom, I guess, within, you know, certain constraints. But I can make this my own as long as I'm, you know, checking off all the things that I'm supposed to do that have been handed down from the authorities. And most people are never really thinking of it beyond that. Now, I understand. I mean, I was in graduate school with people who were public school teachers already in New York and Massachusetts. And they had a lot of complaints. But there was a lot of talk about things that were wrong. And there was no talk, from what I remember, about individual actions that they could take or that they were trying to take. Because it is, I mean, it is for teachers what it is for students. It is just this monstrous machine that makes people feel very powerless. And, you know, I mean, really the best advice I can give, whether you want to be an educator or to be educated, is to stay out of those places.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't mean that you can't, you know, given some tools of intellectual self-defense, that you can't survive it. I would actually say that once you are awake, it's much harder to do as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that would just be incredibly frustrating, especially when the school has these metrics of these standardized tests. And yeah, I mean, I could have been there, Kevin. I mean, this was the track of my education and my career a decade ago. And it was just a few key realizations at the right time that changed my path significantly. I could be a principal right now. My goodness.
Wow.
I can't even imagine what that's like.
Are you doing School Sucks full time now?
Pretty much. I wanted to get away from tutoring for a lot of the reasons that we've actually discussed about higher education, which is really the only purpose of people taking the SAT. There's no other reason to take it if you're not planning to go to college. And it was a little disheartening to look out at a room full of kids who, you know, you're kind of like helping them get into the next box that they have to be stuck in. And I would try to add, you know, suggestions like don't go to college if you don't know what you're going to do. But, you know, that's not really how you survive in that business, being completely open with people. And yeah, I mean, I said, you know, what do I enjoy doing? Like, since I have to do a lot of unpaid work every week for tutoring, it was, you know, calling schools, following up on leads, trying to set up courses, or the podcast, which was, you know, research, recording. And it's not unpaid, right? Because there's eventual rewards for both that are money. But it felt like I'm not getting an hourly wage to do either of these things. And I said, well, I'd rather just reallocate that time to doing the podcast because I enjoy that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a nice example. If I can say to people, yeah, I'm making a living doing exactly what I want. Because I like teaching the SAT class, but I don't like a lot of the feelings and a lot of the, you know, the minutiae that comes with that.
Right.
But I like every aspect of doing School Sucks. You know, like when Dr. Phil tries to sell diet books, mm-hmm. I kind of say, I don't know. Yeah. Something's wrong with this picture. Because Dr. Phil's, you know, he's successful in a lot of ways, but he's a little more overweight than somebody I'd like to buy a diet book from.
Yeah, it's amazing how people fall for that because he's kind of he's looked at as the expert in so many ways. And he can just say, oh, yeah, and then you should eat this diet. And it's like, yeah, you look at some of the stuff that he was selling too. It's like kind of junk foodish.
So if I was doing this podcast and talking about intrinsic motivation and self-actualization and purpose, but then at the same time, I'm like, oh, you know, gosh, I'm just so frustrated with what I have to do every day to make money.
Right.
It's the same kind of thing. And, you know, I'm a subscriber to the George Bernard Shaw idea that, you know, the first duty you have to yourself in life is not to be poor, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Because if all you do is worry about money and financial security, you're really not very useful to anybody else.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Go ahead.
I've gotten the show to a point where if I was making twice as much money, if I had twice as many subscribers, I would be all set, you know, and I'm looking for new opportunities, not just with the podcast, but I've actually had to start just because of the realities of life. I've had to start looking into other tutoring opportunities. And I actually found a company in Connecticut that's actually, they do work around the country. And I think it really, in many ways, aligns with my attitudes and my philosophy. And, you know, I'm investigating whether or not we can have a working relationship. But I think a couple of years ago when I was saying, well, I'm going to make my living running a business that does SAT tutoring, it kind of seemed like just this tunnel that I didn't know where it was going to go. I didn't know how long I would want to do that exclusively. And I managed to get away from academic tutoring, which was so soul-sucking. To have to be an enforcer for the school and the parents who aren't questioning the school, that's not the kind of relationship that I wanted to have with kids. But, you know, I mean, if I could just get over all that stuff, I guess I could make a lot of money doing it. But I don't know. I really don't want to. And I'm the kind of guy who wants to be happy with what I'm doing all day, every day.
Yeah, it goes back to that single motivating purpose that that Jeremy has talked about a lot. If you're aligned with that, it's like everything is so much easier and it doesn't work, isn't a chore. So it becomes a lot more, you're looking forward to it as opposed to like, this is something I have to do and I'm obligated to do and things like that.
So one thing I said to myself the other day was the only times in my life where I really feel uneasy is when I have to spend money.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had to get up today and go get an oil change. And I'm like, I got to spend $30 on an oil change.
Yeah.
Damn. You know, but the rest of today, I'm going to be very happy. That's a nice flip from, let's say, 2007, right?
Right.
Where I lived in a condo on the waterfront in Salem, Massachusetts, and I worked about 50 hours a week. I commuted about 600 miles a week, and there was all kinds of pressure, and I really didn't like anything that I was involved in. And I had two pretty sweet-sounding jobs. I was tutoring for this company outside of Boston, and I was a copywriter for this website that reviewed cars. And everything was just deadlines, and I didn't have the organization system. I didn't have the time management skills, and I was just very stressed. I was making a ton of money compared to what I make now, and I felt like I had nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like I could barely survive because it's just like, and I didn't have the financial education either, because as soon as I knew what it was like to make, you know, $1,500, $1,700 in a week, I was like, well, you know, I'm going to go buy a $35,000 car.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to live in a condo on the water. And it just like immediately everything was eaten up. My standard of living rose to the maximum level that income would allow. And what I've learned in the last couple of years, first of all, trying to start a business, not from the ground, but trying to reinvent a business with this other guy, a business that already existed, and really trying to make the podcast work, is I've learned a kind of resourcefulness that I certainly wouldn't have if I, right out of college, you know, I got a job on Wall Street or in some kind of, you know, sales operation and was making six figures right out of the gate. In the last couple of years, I've been able to develop a resourcefulness that I hope will translate to a day when I have, you know, significantly more income.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, so one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the, you live in New Hampshire. Are you kind of participating in the Free State Project, or is that sort of like you're not even thinking about that at this point?
Kind of participating in the Free State Project would actually be a good description. I certainly support the Free State Project, and, and you know, I was in New Hampshire.
What is it? For people that are listening that don't know, what is the Free State Project?
The Free State Project, I think, is really described as a vehicle to get people to New Hampshire. So technically, once you get to New Hampshire, you know, you don't have to say, well, I'm a Free Stater, or I'm part of the Free State Project, or I'm participating in the Free State Project, because you've done your part. You've moved to New Hampshire. You participated in the Free State Project. And, you know, what has been set up as a result, largely as a result of the Free State Project in New Hampshire, is at least three, probably more, distinct communities in Grafton, Manchester, and Keene, three different locations where, you know, Keene and Manchester are cities. Keene is more focused on civil disobedience and media. Manchester, oh, I'm sorry, Concord. I always forget about the political people.
Yeah.
Concord, where people, you know, are more involved in politics. That has spread down into this neighboring city of Manchester. There's a lot of political people there getting involved in local government. I mean, everybody's hierarchy of values is different, but I just don't understand. I imagine that being incredibly frustrating. You know, and people can go there once they recognize that, yes, it would make sense to move a bunch of like-minded people to the same place. Obviously, you know, I mean, if everybody was exactly like-minded, we could just be Republicans and Democrats, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this separation, and it's not so much hostility. There might be some rivalry from community to community as far as what people are doing as far as activism and outreach. But most of the time that I was there, I was in Manchester, and I did my own thing. I met some great people who had moved to New Hampshire as the result of the Free State Project. There's certainly no shortage of people with similar values that you can hang out with every day. So there's a lot of benefits to the whole Free State Project thing. But I never really saw myself as a participant. I mean, I was a New Hampshire native. I joined the Free State Project in 2007 and moved back from Massachusetts and didn't really do anything. Didn't even let anyone know I was there until after I started the podcast. So then around 2010, I started to network. I started to make some friends. I started to be more visible. And I would definitely say it was a generally positive experience, but I do want to also be able to go out and explore different areas and meet different people and see different communities. And I've been in Connecticut for a month working with the folks from Tragedy and Hope. And that's been, you know, one of the most positive and transformative experiences that I've had in years. So, and I'm kind of, you know, I might stay there a little while longer, but I'm also kind of thinking, like, what's next? Where could I go next? What other kind of experiences could I have?
Yeah.
You know, while I'm, the only thing that I'm tied to is the show, that can go anywhere with me. I mean, obviously, I can't take a whole studio, but I can take what I need to do the show. So I'm kind of feeling free and mobile right now.
Yeah,
I'm interested to see where that will lead.
You're building freedom in an unfree world, like I always talk about.
Right, right.
Do you think that there's any benefit? I think this is the one thing that I think I talked about this with Jeremy, and, you know, I've talked about it with other people, but is there any benefit to civil disobedience and liberty activism versus just going out there and doing something like what you did, like start your own show or start your own business that, you know, you can build freedom in your own life?
I don't know. I mean, this is my assessment of it. And again, this comes down to a hierarchy of values question, because, you know, I look at somebody like Ian Freeman or Adam Kokesh or Derek Jay, and I say, I wouldn't do that, you know? And I look at them and I look at their talents and I say, Adam Kokesh is more useful out of jail. Ian Freeman is more, if the goal is to spread this philosophy, and my assessment is that those talented people are more useful on the side of a jail cell where they can access microphones and mixers and, you know, video cameras, like, versus the other side of the jail cell where they can access none of that stuff. I don't like the idea of martyrdom. Mm-hmm. I think that that's kind of a religious extremist mindset that I will sacrifice for the greater good. So I don't see any nobility in being in jail. But this is just me. You know, I mean, I've really worked hard to be more understanding of these mindsets that other people have. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I don't understand it. I don't understand it. I don't know what drives them to do it, because it's just something that's not in me. Yeah. But maybe there's a line. Maybe there's a line that I haven't reached, you know, that they crossed.
Yeah.
And I try to avoid those lines being laid out. My car has license plates on it. It's registered.
Yeah.
I have a valid driver's license. But is there a line? You know, is there a line that, like, if I was sick, you know, and I had to use marijuana, and I was arrested and it was taken away, or I was put under house arrest, or I had to wear an ankle bracelet. Is that my line? I don't know. I haven't thought that much about it, because my goal is to, as far as the furtherance of this philosophy is concerned and this message, is to stay in a locality where I'm useful. Mm-hmm. And jail, I see as not one of those localities.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's my take on it. But if you look at the bigger picture beyond the individual, what has civil disobedience and Keene done for, you know, the promotion of the Free State Project, or the promotion of these ideas generally? You could say that, you know, if that's the frame of evaluation that you want to use, that there has been some successes. And I think it just comes down to the individual and what's important to the individual.
Mm-hmm.
But I just have a terrible time understanding why people do that. Believe me, like, Ian and Derek have tried to explain it to me. We did like an hour long show one night talking about this. And people can find that. And it was actually, I think, the most popular show we ever did was with Derek J. Freeman from Derek's Victimless Crime Spree. And it was, you know, about the appeal to force. But I'm doing my best to be understanding of that. And it's just not me. So I hate to armchair what anybody else is doing, you know, like,
sure,
sit there and say, well, you know, that's silly, because I don't know what's important to them. I'm not them. I know what's important to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully what I do reflects that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, cool. I think we'll wrap it up there. I just wanted to mention your podcast. Again, it's Brett Vinat, and his website is schoolsucksproject.com, and it's the School Sucks Podcast. Definitely go check it out. Listen to a few shows. He's got some amazing, just really cool, interesting topics, whether you're in school or not. If you're in business, I mean, I've been listening to some of the latest shows, and it's actually motivated me to get more organized. I mean, I'm like super...
Good.
Yeah, I'm super unorganized, and I'm like, wow, this is like really, really good stuff. And the way you guys present it is like, okay, that makes total sense. You know, yeah, it's not too difficult. So, yeah.
Yeah, and just for my audience, I want to let you know that I'm about to start digging back into Healthy Mind, Fit Body podcast, the show that you did with Wes.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, I almost said mining for gold, but I guess I'm just going to kind of walk around and pick up all the gold you guys left lying around.
Oh, nice.
Because it was such a useful podcast for people who are concerned with nutrition and exercise and the mindset that, you know, goes to the building of a better life. So I've recommended it to my audience before, but I am going to start going back through. I just downloaded, I think, like 30 or 40 episodes that I wanted to revisit. And I wanted to thank you for that, because it was really inspiring and just a wonderful presentation from beginning to end, everything I heard. And that's kind of where my mind is now on improvement and productivity. And I think that's a great thing for me to start revisiting, as far as continuously, not just remembering mindset, but the importance of mindset, but also improving it. So,
yeah, well, I'm glad someone's still listening to it and getting something out of it. We did 100 episodes and then we just called it. But yeah, that's great. I'm really glad to hear that. And it does come down to mindset and psychology when it comes to nutrition. I used to get into depth with all the different, you know, the paleo stuff and low carb, and really tell people. I wanted to tell everybody and educate everybody on this stuff. But most people weren't really listening, even if they really wanted to hear it from me, they just, it was really tough to convince anybody of this stuff. But when you get into it, it's really comes down to psychology. And that's the toughest part about fitness and weight loss and all that, is there are a lot of blocks out there, but it's not like they can't be overcome. So
yeah, it's frustrating, isn't it? Where it's like, oh, that's nice that you're passionate about something, but I'm going to just go over here where there's government school and Wonder Bread.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard.
Pretty much.
It is hard. I've definitely experienced some small successes with, you know, the political stuff and the nutrition stuff. My mother stopped eating gluten, which I think is great.
Awesome.
And she's realized all kinds of positive benefits of that. And yeah, so, you know, it's a continuous struggle, but it's worth it. And yeah, it can be fun. We can enjoy every moment of it. So
yeah,
that's what
absolutely
I try to do.
Cool, man. Well, hey, keep up the great work over there and good luck with everything. I can't wait to see what's next.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Freedom Lovin' Podcast. To break free today, head on over to freedomlovin.com and download our free guide, 7 Practical Tips to Living Free in an Unfree World.